about them Irish.
I can't take it anymore. I need a national championship.
This is the Four Horsemen Podcast.
The NLRB files an unfair labor practice against the University of Notre Dame. The legal landscape that comes with that, the blue and gold game, and of course the NFL draft. Strap in, get yourself a nice drink, some snacks. This is going to be a long one. I'm Dylan, joined by Steve as always, and it's the Four Horsemen Podcast coming back at you to talk all sorts of college football news, the big ones being what I just mentioned. Steve, how are you doing today?
Hanging in there, man. We are obviously missing one Mr. P Wagon. He's on dad duty. I'm pretty sure we announced previously on the last show, which was December. But yeah, I'm also about to be a dad. Shout out me. I've had sex. Thank you. Appreciate it. So I'm like T minus less than 90 days away from being on dad duty myself. Yeah, we're doing a little bit of nesting. A lot of house projects has been taking up the vast majority of my time. That's why we're a little bit scarce here and there with the episodes, but certainly more coming in the future. But happy to talk Notre Dame football with you today, buddy.
I love it. Do you know if it's a boy or a girl, or you guys chose not to know?
The latter. Yeah, we're not going to find out. Not to get too over philosophical, but in a world where like technology is ubiquitous and we just know everything instantly all the time, it's kind of cool to just go a little bit old school and just let the world, you know, kind of just play itself out. You know, there's no control we have over it anyway. So a nice surprise is going to be really cool.
That's awesome. Well, congrats, Steve, and your wife, Maddie, of course. I know that's such an exciting time, and a lot of our listeners probably have children of their own and can relate. So good luck not sleeping for another few years. And hopefully these podcasts can get you through the day. But yeah, let's start with what the hell's going on. So the National Labor Relations Board is a federal body in the United States that covers private workplace disputes and labor charges, unions, things of that nature. Something I wanted to talk about today, Steve, because one, not that I'm an expert, but I do have a law degree and I'm about to be a lawyer, so at least this puts some use to that. But what I'm hoping to do here is just sort of summarize and communicate in a sort of an effective way to the audience what's going on and discuss kind of the implications this has on Notre Dame, on the wider world of the NCAA, how this ties into all this conference realignment we're talking about. I'm by no means an expert. I'm one Canadian, so this is not my field of expertise to begin with, but it's more so just to kind of get to the points so people can understand what the hell's going on. And yeah, we'll start from there. So do you have any questions before I jump right into it?
Yeah. What does NLRB stand for?
It's the National Labor Relations Board.
Okay. All right, for one, baby.
So what has happened is a quick summary here, and I'll give some context because it relates to a larger web of things that are going on. An advocacy group called the College Basketball Players Association is led by a man named Michael Sue. He is a former University of Minnesota regent, and he's been leading a lot of these cases. There is a push to give employee status to student athletes at these universities, including a court case I'll talk about. But this is sort of the private institution route. The court cases are going to deal with things on a broader scale, but the NLRB is something for private employers. So this is something they're trying to get going simultaneously with some other issues to try to make progress on employee status. So Michael Sue is not affiliated with Notre Dame. I don't want to call him a troublemaker, but he's been leading a bit of an advocacy movement there around some other universities, including cases at Dartmouth, Northwestern, and USC. We'll talk about those as well. You may ask yourself, how can somebody not affiliated with Notre Dame file this complaint on behalf of Notre Dame athletes. And it's important to note there's no specific athletic team being mentioned. It's just Notre Dame student athletes broadly. So in law, there's a concept called standing, meaning to be in a certain proceeding, you have to have standing, a certain legal interest in the proceeding. At the NLRB, you do not have to have that. That requirement doesn't exist, so anybody can file a charge. So first things first, that's how this got filed. To make it clear, nobody at Notre Dame has done so. We do not know what the Notre Dame student athletes think of this. They could agree, they could disagree. It's kind of weird that this is being brought upon someone who is totally not related to Notre Dame on behalf of Notre Dame people. But that's the world we're in now. So far, so good.
Yeah, makes sense. My rudimentary knowledge of standing is basically I can't sue somebody else because they got hit in a crosswalk. They can sue because they got hit in a crosswalk. I can't sue on behalf of them. But in this case, this is just kind of go over where he has standing a little bit more.
Yeah. So like if you and another person have a contractual dispute, I can't just come in and side with one of you unless I have a particular interest in what's going on. But because that requirement doesn't exist, that's how they got around it. So the official charge is called a unfair labor practice charge, ULP. And basically what the accusation here is that for the last 6 months, which goes back to the timing of this is interesting, Notre Dame has been wrongfully classifying its student athletes as student athletes, when in fact the argument is they are employees. And by doing so, Notre Dame is suppressing their employee rights. And that's the unfair labor practice. This is something that every school is doing. It's nothing Notre Dame did in particular. It's just Notre Dame is one of the big targets they could go after. So the case with Dartmouth, you may have heard of. This is the basketball players. They petitioned the NLRB on their own behalf. They wanted to hold a union election, and they won. The board sided in favor of Dartmouth. They voted to unionize, and now that is being contested. That's on appeal, and the Ivy League is a big part of that. The reason Dartmouth was chosen was because they're a private institution in a fully private league. There was a case at Northwestern in 2015 where the football players tried to unionize, and they brought it to the NLRB, and they dismissed it. They said they did not have jurisdiction because Northwestern is part of the Big Ten Conference, which has public schools in various states and various employment laws associated with that. So they didn't feel like that was the appropriate forum for them. Jack Swarbrick has already said that that is the correct decision and should apply here. You know, we'll see. The USC case came before Notre Dame, and that's nearing a decision. We'll probably have an idea how this is going to go before Notre Dame is in any kind of proceeding there. This was for the football and the women's basketball teams. Again, this was filed on behalf of them. The argument is that the employees, that the student athletes are employees of the school, the Pac-12 conference, and the NCAA. They're trying to say that those three entities are joint employers. And if they were to win or lose, whichever way it goes, the appeal would go to federal court. And that's kind of what, from what I've read, that is the goal. They want to get this to a federal court and have a judge make a decision here. The NLRB is a federal body. And Michael Hsu had said that the reason for the timing of this Notre Dame case is because the United States is going into an election year. Obviously, in November of 2024, you will be voting. Changes could be made, and then changes could be made on these boards and these rules associated with these boards, which could change the outcome for employee status. So there's a bit of a political undertone here, which is kind of interesting.
Wait a second.
Yeah.
There's an election this year. I hadn't noticed.
I love that. So that's been playing a factor in their minds. So with Notre Dame, because Notre Dame football is independent, the legal argument, and this is coming from Michael McCann, a lot of my summary here is from here, he's a sports lawyer, is that because Notre Dame is independent, that is one less joint employer to prove. They are only trying to prove now Notre Dame and the NCAA are joint employers, and they're both denying these student-athletes' employee status. So Notre Dame has come out with a statement that basically says sports is an integrated part of our educational mission. It is absolutely part of what we do here, and they are student athletes. that is basically the crux of it. There'll be more complex legal arguments as they go. But here is what it comes down to. As stated by Michael McCann, whether Notre Dame athletes are employees turns on a legal question. Do the players perform work for Notre Dame in exchange for compensation? And does the school have the right to control that work? That's kind of what determines employee status. So that's where things are going to be fought. It's not an indication that Notre Dame did anything wrong. It's just this is the practice. Notre Dame's a big target, and they're going after Notre Dame. They are not going after public schools because they don't have jurisdiction to do so. And it's part of a larger series of court cases. There are two buckets, Steve. There is the employee bucket, and there's the antitrust bucket. So before we get to antitrust, I'll just finish up with the employee status, because there is a court case going on right now called Johnson versus the NCAA. And it argues for employee status and that they should have been paid hourly like other students. Again, they're performing work for compensation. They've been denied that compensation, and therefore they are owed a lot of money. Basically denied employee rights as per the Fair Labor Standards Act in the United States. This had already been brought to court, and the courts had denied it in 2016 and 2019, the cases of Berger and Dawson. However, things have changed a lot on this front. Things have changed politically, how we conceptualize student-athletes with the NIL rulings. So there's a good chance this goes in favor of student-athletes. That's something to keep an eye on. So I'll pause right there. That was a lot to kind of get through on the employee status, but basically court case coming, and then these private filings with the NLRB, Notre Dame being one of them, USC, Northwestern, Dartmouth being the others. We'll see where we're going with that. Any questions, Steve?
Yeah, so I guess if I'm the university, my argument is that they're not employees, they're independent contractors. Because they're not even going with that.
They're saying just student athletes are their own thing.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. And I mean, they are student athletes, like literally, like they can't participate on the field unless they are in good standing academically. Like that is their first and foremost, technically, role within the university. And with the new NIL rules, they are not preventing them from making money off their own name, image, and likeness. So these individuals can get paid. They're being compensated in the form of an education for free, which has a market value of $250,000. Yep. Right. And they're also provided state-of-the-art training facilities, athletic trainers, coaching, all that sort of stuff. So I mean, I just don't want to get to the point of schools actually paying athletes. I have no problem with the student athletes profiting with name, image, and likeness. I think to a certain point, kind of going off on a little bit of tangent, I think maybe if we were to implement some sort of salary cap, so to speak, because an 18-year-old high school student should not be getting $1 million. That's just insane because they're unproven. And that's
one thing you and I have always discussed and have kind of agreed upon, despite being different politically, is we both kind of agree that student athletes deserve to be able to make some money because the broadcasting revenue that is coming in is absurd. Like they are making billions of dollars and the student athletes are seeing none of it. And that's just really, I think, unfair to people. That doesn't mean they have to be employees. There are other models out there that I think work. And there's one I want to talk about. We've discussed it on the podcast. And you'd be familiar with this, too. Charlie Baker is the president of the NCAA, the former governor of Massachusetts. And he had made a new proposal. You may remember this, Steve. It was to make a new subdivision of NCAA sports for football and basketball to kind of be separate. And it was an idea of how are we going to deal with all these court cases? How are we going to deal with all these issues? And just to summarize that, because I was a big fan of it because I think it works with the Notre Dame model really well. So here's the brief recap of what that model could look like. Schools would pay in two ways for student athletes. One, NIL contracts, so name, image, and likeness contracts, would be paid directly by the universities, not the collectives and all the bullshit that's going around it, right? On a side note, the state of Virginia has just made a law that is allowing their schools to directly make those payments to the student athletes. So we could be heading in that direction anyway. So that's the first part of this, is you could pay NIL on your own. There'd probably be rules. I don't know about salary cap, but there might be limits, something along those lines. The second part is that you'll be paying athletes through an education trust. And the details are, the initial proposal will include a minimum investment of $30,000 per year to at least half of the school's athletes, with equal monetary consideration and opportunities for male and female athletes to comply with Title IX. And that would guarantee that half of the school's athletes would make at least $120,000 over 4 years of their competition. So there's a way to make sure everybody gets paid through this trust. And then there's the NIL contracts directly to sort of, let's be honest, football brings in 95% of the revenue. Okay, so they're going to get their market share, and that's kind of for them. There would be an opt-out for people to self-govern. So the NCAA would no longer deal with those rules, right? That's where you would see Division I football kind of go on its own and start to make its own rules. And the big part is that this is in conjunction with people lobbying for Congress. So Jack Swarbrick and Notre Dame has been one of the bigger voices on this. They want Congress to give an exemption for employee status of student athletes. They want Congress to give a different kind of status where they can get compensated, but they would not legally be considered employees, because that changes the dynamic completely of college sports. You are now under an employment contract. What does that imply for transfers?
Mm-hmm.
Right? What does that mean for other kind of working conditions? Right? You have an option to, you know, you're still on scholarship. You could be fired theoretically under an employment contract. Totally different situation here that Notre Dame does not want. That most schools, I don't think, want. And what they're asking for is Congress to just give a special exemption. So regardless of what the court cases find, student athletes are not employees. They are this instead. So that is the NCAA's proposed model. I don't know if that's going to win. It's the one I like. What are your thoughts on that?
Okay. I don't know, man. There's so much to it. Because there's an element of redistributionism with it, but also it's like it's still letting people kind of cash in and take, you know, advantage of it. Like I think of like the Cavender twins, the two blonde girls on the University of Miami basketball team. Like and you know, this is the Pareto principle, which ultimately is like the top 10% effectively get all of the assets of anything. The top 10% of anyone in any sort of craft are going to get effectively 90% of everything, right? And that's, you know, stocks, business, politics, whatever that may be. That's the Pareto principle. So like those twin girls, you know, even though it's female basketball and you know, statistically speaking, like that's going to have less eyeballs and less revenue. They make probably seven figures in terms of like with their TikTok and like all those sort of advertisement deals. But then there's also going to be someone from like Southwest, you know, Louisiana State Mud Dogs, SELSU Mud Dogs, that might make like $750 a year in nil. Right. So like, there's going to inherently be those discrepancies and rightfully so. I mean, if you're worth something more, go get more. But I also don't want to, at a certain point, there's an integrity to college sports that I want to try to keep at some point. Like I'm okay with guys cashing in and getting some sort of payment in return for everything. But on the flip side, it's like, again, it's like an unproven 18-year-old kid that just so happened to, you know, score a couple of touchdowns in high school, all of a sudden he's going to get a seven-figure deal when he hasn't played a down of college football, when you have, you know, 70% of Americans right now that are like really, really fucking struggling because of a lot of different economic factors. So I'm trying not to come from a point of jealousy and everything. Again, like if you have a market value, go get your market value. But at the end of the day, these people are, you know, these kids, they are kids. They're getting $250,000 worth of education, sometimes more. You know, they're going to be in the good old boys club, right? Like any, like mm-hmm. Sierre Wood, running back from what, 2014, 13, whatever year that would be. If he goes to any function where there's a Notre Dame alumni, it doesn't matter his qualifications. He's going to be in with the in crowd. He could walk up to, he could know nothing about investment banking and just be like, I'm Sierre Wood. It's nice to meet you. I'm class of 13, whatever. And then there's a very real possibility that Sierre Wood gets a job in investment banking, making like $250,000 a year. Like there is that value of a Notre Dame degree, you know, specifically to Notre Dame. And that could, you know, you kind of amplify that out to like a University of Alabama alum and so on and so forth. So again, like these, it's not like these athletes are going to be, I don't know. Like there's so many different
well, one thing is
contradictory views I have.
In the proposed model here from Charlie Baker, and also if they just end up being employees and they start to collectively bargain with the conferences, there's going to be rules. There's going to be rules on these things. And I think one of them is that there will be finally a mechanism that isn't just the NCAA's bullshit rules to enforce rules on not just transfers, but also recruiting. And I think what you would see is in this breakaway subdivision model, there would be, hey, listen, this is a cap of what you can pay for recruits, or no recruits can be guaranteed money, or whatever the deal is. You might finally have it regulated. And I don't think any of these schools want to pay kids who haven't played down millions of dollars. This is the free-for-all Wild West we're in right now with NIL. And you're seeing that starting to get less and less because now schools are – they only have so many resources. They're allocating that to transfers because they're more proven players. So you're going to start seeing rules on transfers, whether that be, you know, so many times or it's a cap. At least with these models, you'll start to rein in NIL a little bit. If you're paying for these NIL contracts directly, well, then you're limiting some of the fake NIL stuff that's going out there. And then student-athletes can just – in addition to getting compensation for their name, image, and likeness, they could also, with the school, they could also have a deal with Chipotle, as Joelt does. They could, you know, sign a local car dealership deal. They can sell their own autographs on merchandise, which is what it was meant to be, and it's something that they've always should have had. So I think, yes, the integrity of the sport is going to be one thing, but at least some of the stuff we hate right now might get reined in a little bit. So I'm not really sure what the model is. If they become employees, that will have an impact on Notre Dame because they'll be collectively bargaining probably with the conferences. In Charlie Baker's model, they directly negotiate their NIL contracts with the schools. That's different. So what happens for Notre Dame? Okay, sure, all the other sports that are in the ACC, except hockey, which is in the Big Ten, they would have those deals with those conferences. But what happens to the football team? Are you going to collectively bargain with them? And what does that mean for your resources? Can you offer the same amount the Big Ten could offer their employees? So this has a big implication on Notre Dame employee status versus not. And it could affect independence. Now, at the same time, Notre Dame could say, our pockets are deep. We'll collectively bargain with you directly, football team, and we'll pay top dollar. And that works, too. But you need to be kind of aware that these things are happening. So that's my thoughts on it. There's also the antitrust thing. So before I move there, do you have any more questions with the employees stuff or?
No, my last one, which you pretty much just answered, was, okay, in the realm of Notre Dame football, how does this affect independence? And the answer is we won't know until we know. You know, it's got to play out. And if it, I mean, the Notre Dame coffers definitely have some, you know, some shekels that they can pass along. And I hope that they, you know, open up the bag and support Marcus Freeman has always been my position and the position of this podcast. But also on the flip side, like I've gone back and forth a couple of times here. Like I don't want kids to get paid, but it kind of seems inevitable. There's a million different factors. At the end of the day, there's so much legalese to kind of sift through where I'm going to get my primitive ape brain and just say Notre Dame football win. That's all I care about going forward. So like, obviously I want independence, but Notre Dame football win. That's end goal.
Yep. I 100% agree. And I think Notre Dame's done a pretty good job of opening up the pocketbooks recently. I don't think NIL is a problem anymore, we get any kind of grad transfer we want. The key emphasis there is grad. And I think the money's being there for Marcus Freeman. I mean, he just signed Coach Mike Denbrock from LSU, and that wasn't cheap. He's got maybe the two most expensive coordinators in college football right now. So I like that from Notre Dame. I'm with you. As long as they keep supporting the team in any way, I'm happy with it. So I'll just shift to the antitrust cases. So what does that mean? Antitrust is basically a series of laws that are meant to protect fair trade. It's meant to prevent monopolies. It's meant to keep competition fair in the marketplace in your country. The argument is, and what the Supreme Court found by a unanimous decision, and Steve, you and I know how hard it is for the Supreme Court of the United States to have a unanimous agreement on anything, okay? They unanimously agreed that the NCAA's restrictions on eligibility and compensation with respect to these Alston awards, I'll come back to that, violated federal antitrust laws by barring the athletes from receiving fair market compensation for their labor. So they placed an unfair restraint on trade by saying you are not eligible for these benefits, and that is the antitrust violation, okay? So there is a big, big case right now. There's three of them. There's two ongoing and one previous one I want to talk about. The big one right now is called House versus the NCAA. This is a class action lawsuit against the NCAA and the Power Five conferences. They argue that they had violated the antitrust with their NIL restrictions. So when the NCAA implemented NIL, these restrictions had violated antitrust, and they did so by not sharing broadcast revenue. So this is a class action lawsuit. The claim is for multi-billions, and the numbers I saw were between $1.4 and $3 billion if this were to go in their favor. And this would be for payments and retroactive payments dating back to 2020 whenever these rules were implemented. They're saying since these rules were implemented, they were antitrust, so everyone from that moment onwards is owed compensation. This is a big one because it ties into conference realignment. And I'll get there soon. So we're talking billions. They'll probably settle. Class action lawsuits, usually they got certified, they'll settle. But you're still talking probably $1 billion in compensation. There was a second case called Hubbard versus NCAA. This is named after Chuba Hubbard, the Canadian running back for Oklahoma State. They allege antitrust against the NCAA and several of the conferences for not being allowed to receive Alston Awards. Remember I just mentioned that? Mm-hmm. These are educationally related benefits and financial awards directly from the schools. The NCAA athletes were not eligible for this, the other students were. And they said by denying us this benefit. This is all NCAA. Chuba Hubbard was a Canadian, but it doesn't matter for the sake. All student athletes in the NCAA have been denied this benefit for educational and financial awards. Just by their status, and they're saying that's an antitrust violation. So in the case of NCAA versus Alston, this was the first case that kind of set the tone, the one I told you about with the unanimous Supreme Court decision. They found they did find that there was antitrust violations, but it could be allowed in a limited and restrictive circumstance. However, these benefits did not meet that threshold. These benefits were not minimally restrictive violations. They were pretty big violations. So this case kind of opened the door. And I believe it was Justice Kavanaugh in a concurring opinion. They did not touch NIL in this decision, Steve. NCAA versus Alston did not touch that. But I believe it was Kavanaugh's decision that made it very clear if we get to this, it's going to be the same kind of outcome. So Hubbard is seeking damages for all athletes of the Power Five dating back to 2019 when this case, when these rules came out. So you're talking, Steve, two major class action lawsuits in House versus NCAA and Hubbard versus NCAA that will see billions owed to student athletes. Billions. There are other cases going on that I haven't mentioned. These are just the main ones. So this is part of, again, two buckets. There's the employee status that Notre Dame is fighting on the private level, and there's a court case called Johnson on it, and there's the antitrust violations. What does this all mean? Well, if you're wondering why Oklahoma and Texas went to the SEC and why USC and UCLA and then others, Oregon, Washington, went to the Big Ten, and why the Pac-12 fell apart, part of it is this. Part of it is the administrators and the university presidents see this coming down the pipeline. They know this is a losing battle. One, they're going to have to start paying these students either as employees or in some other kind of model, which is going to be, you know, millions in redistribution. And two, they're going to owe billions in damages for these violations. Assuming the court, you know, the courts aren't done yet, but I think everybody's kind of expecting them to settle or find in favor of the athletes. So what their idea, this is called the stratification line, other people have said, they need to be able to make so much money to pay for all this. And then on another level, you need to be able to stay competitive. So once you make this payouts, right, and this is why the Power Five, now called the Autonomous Four or Five, whatever we're getting at, kind of want to separate and leave their own thing, because they'll say, you know what, we'll pay for most of this because we make the most money, but we're starting our own rules. And that's kind of where that model comes in with Charlie Baker's proposal. So you have that aspect of it, of how the hell are we going to pay for all this, which is why they're getting into bigger conferences that make more money from networks so they could afford it. And then also, because you're going to have to start paying these people on a routine basis, you're going to have to be in one of these conferences that make the most money so you can offer the most money so student athletes can come play for you. That's kind of where we're headed. And that's why people are dying to get into the Big Ten and dying to get into the SEC. Because if they become employees, you'll be collectively bargaining with those conferences, and those two conferences will be able to offer a lot more money than everyone else. Or if it's another model, you're still going to have to compete with other universities to pay for them. And if you are, let's pick a school in the Big 12, Oklahoma State, how are you going to look at, you know, some high school kid and say, you shouldn't go to the University of Oklahoma because X, Y, and Z, but Oklahoma can pay you triple the amount we can, right? That's a problem. That's why we're headed for all these, this just an avalanche. It's just crazy. Super conferences could be it. We don't know. It's just, it's an avalanche of change in a sport that has never really had change come quickly. Change has always been slow in college football. It's not anymore. It's coming fast because of all these cases. Everything here is tied. And that's why people are thinking this is the time Notre Dame has to make a decision. However, Notre Dame has been able to make as much money, because the main way this is coming in is through these network deals. They've been able to keep pace. And Notre Dame has the ability to raise funds in other ways. So we'll see. I don't know what's going to happen. I think if Notre Dame can financially manage it, they will keep being independent. But it's something that could force us into a conference. So I just wanted to bring everyone's attention to this, just to explain what this NLRB charge was against Notre Dame, how this ties into a larger picture, and what that can mean going forward. So thank you for letting me monologue there. Hopefully this was clear for people. If not, feel free to reach out. Steve, do you have any kind of questions or jumping off points from here?
No, you were very thorough. And my question was going to be, or my quip was going to be, okay, so it kind of sounds like Notre Dame's going to be forced into the Big Ten, which at this point, given what you laid out, I would begrudgingly accept, but I am going to continue to hold out hope for independence. The only comment that I have after, I mean, you literally just hit all the points, so I have no additional questions, just a comment, and it's a funny one, so please laugh. Jeb Bush, please clap. There's going to be so many fucking commercials now.
Yep.
And this is why the 2-minute warning has been implemented, huh?
Apparently, they will not be taking a commercial break. I read that somewhere. I don't know if that's true.
Yeah,
that probably won't last for long. But you're right. Like, this is all to make more money, and they're going to do that with more commercials. That's where we're going.
The hyper corporatization of everything, man. Just I'm a free market capitalist as it gets, but at a certain point, Jesus fucking Christ, can we just play some football?
Well, yeah, that's what it comes down to. And all these networks things started changing in the 80s. There was, surprise, another court case that had deemed, because the NCAA would kind of negotiate, I think, broadcasting deals for the entire sport. And they found that was an antitrust violation. And it was actually Notre Dame was, I think, if not the first, one of the first to go out and get its own network deal with NBC in the early 90s. That's why it took that long. Notre Dame would have been able to get a TV deal at any point. But once that became optional, things only escalated from there. And, you know, Notre Dame's not responsible for any of this. This is what everybody would do and has done. It's just the deals keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger because TV is dying. The only thing keeping it alive is live sports. So this is where a lot of money's coming from. And you might start to see direct services, whether that's Peacock, ESPN Plus, who knows? The future could be different. And there's an ongoing partnership between Fox and Disney right now, which could have implications on a lot of things as well. So the sports business side of it is very interesting. As somebody who works currently in a corporate legal environment, it's very interesting to me. Is it good for the sport? Probably not. But change is coming. And I just want to give the audience a heads up on that. But I'm sick of it. Steve, is it time to talk some football or what?
Let's talk about some football before I'm not going to finish the sentence.
Well, the spring game, the Blue Gold Classic, was last week. Notre Dame Blue Team won a very good game, high-scoring game, relatively speaking, for a running clock. Man, do those quarterbacks look good.
Yeah, it's a deep QB room. And I threw out the tweet couple days ago, or probably even the day of the Blue Gold game, so last Saturday, that yeah, this does appear to be kind of the deepest QB room in recent Notre Dame history. At least I think there was Malik Zaire, but you know, I don't think he ended up being what we would have hoped, and then that kind of trickled into Deshaun Kizer, so like that was pretty good. And then there was, you know, but like if Ian Book ever got injured, who was his backup, right? We were kind of screwed.
Don't know who the backup was. It Drew Pine? Like off the top of my head, I'm trying to think who the backup was in 2020. I think it was Drew Pine.
Yeah, I think so. Yes, and we know how that would have played out. And then before that, like then you know it was Everett Golson, Tommy Reese. Before that, it was Dane Crist and Jimmy Clausen, which I think was probably the best duo that we had had. Mm-hmm. At least throughout the early aughts, all the way down into the 90s when we're getting in, what was it, Rick Meyer in 93?
Yeah, Rick Meyer. Brady Quinn, of course, in the mid-2000s was great.
Yeah, geez, my brain just stopped working. But who was in the QB room behind Brady Quinn? Is, you know?
Like, yeah, no idea. Matt
Lavecchio. Shout out to you with his Matt Lavecchio reference. He always has to get one. But
speaking of P-Wagon references, our quarterback rooms for the last 20 years have looked a lot like Auburn's Cam Newton wide receiver room when they won a national championship. And we all know how desperately thin that room was from about, you know, 100 podcasts ago. It was exciting to see. I mean, what were your big takeaways from the game or from what you saw of the game? You know, is there anybody that kind of intrigued you, got you excited for the season?
Secondary is going to eat, but I mean, I forget which wide receiver it was that had the stop and go route that kind of cooked that cornerback and was wide open with, Angeli found him down the sideline.
Yeah, Chris Mitchell, the Florida International
FIU. Yeah.
I think it's FIU transfer. And then the cornerback was actually a non-scholarship player, but you know, for the sake of, you know, Chris Mitchell, you know, is the dude, man. That was a great move.
No, and that's what I was gonna get. I mean, we know our secondary is gonna cook this year. It's a legitimate no fly zone. Like you have better luck flying over like Nellis Air Force Base than you do in Notre Dame Stadium this year. but yeah, so the wide receivers though have been impressive. You know, the offensive line, we still don't know what they're going to be against like top end competition, and that's kind of been the critique of Notre Dame recently, is like against low tier and then even mid tier and even like high mid tier, they've been pretty damn good. But then you just think back to the Louisville game and they kind of just imploded, and that really sucked. And that Louisville defensive line was very, very good. And even against Ohio State, like our offensive line was very good, but not great. And if we can get that step up to great, if we can get five Joe Waltz across the board, I mean, obviously who wouldn't want five top 10 picks on your offensive line, right? But, But yeah, I mean, we'll see how that offensive line holds up, but the quarterbacks seem to be maturing. Kenny Minchie, you know, he made a little mistake with the interception. No big deal. He came back and had a rushing touchdown, had a passing touchdown. And Jelly, we know his body of work, you know, especially with the, you know, the end of last season, and he played pretty well here. And yeah, and then obviously there's CJ Carr, who was throwing darts out there, and he looks like he might have like the biggest pop in his arm of anyone in the QB room as a true freshman. So we're very deep, and we didn't even see Riley Leonard. You know, so we have four legit dudes that might possibly get down to three by the time we get into to August, but hopefully all four stay because the quarterback position just and the wide receivers are kind of, you know, getting themselves open and really make those guys look good. So all around, I don't know. I just feel like if you look up and down this roster, and we'll do a full roster breakdown as we get a little bit deeper into the summer and as things kind of crystallize. But I'm starting to see very, very few weaknesses in this roster, and it's a very exciting time. But I only saw portions of the game, again, just because like house projects and a whole bunch of other stuff in my life. But Dylan, you were a bit more tapped in, so please give us all of your thoughts and opinions.
Yeah, I watched the game and tweeted along live with it. I was impressed with everybody. I don't think anybody looked too bad, if that makes sense. I was concerned for the offensive line. The offensive line to me is the big question mark, just because it's young. I don't think we expected Blake Fisher to leave. So they're young at tackle, Jagasaw on the left. And it's a battle between Tosh Baker and Emil Wagner for the right tackle position. Through the middle, it's going to be Ashton Craig, I think the starting center. He took over parts of last season, as did Billy Shrouth on the interior. And then Pat Coogan and Rocco Spindler are kind of battling there for that last guard spot. So I was curious to see how the offensive line would do. Now, they lost to the D-line because the D-line's better. The D-line, the interior D-line is ridiculous. Notre Dame's... They might have the best defensive tackle group in the country, like right up there with Michigan and the SEC schools, because Riley Mills, Howard Cross is bang, bang up there with anybody. You add Jason Onye as your third. Are you joking? Gabriel Rubio. You got Brennan Tyson. Vernon, Tyson Ford. We all saw Sean Siliano Jr., the biggest man on the roster, the true freshman, another Canadian boy. I love it. And there's just a lot of talent there. So the D-line is great. They won the day, but I thought the offensive line held up enough to give the quarterbacks time to throw the ball. And that was encouraging. Sure, Jagasaw got beat a few times, but he was also going up against RJ Oben, the Duke transfer, who was just fantastic. Boubacar Traore really, I think, cemented himself as maybe the next Viper that is going to come off the edge. That's my one concern, is the Viper position, just pass rush in general. As good as the D-line is, who's going to get the quarterback? But look, the receivers look great, and half of them weren't even there. We know how good they are with all the transfers we brought in. The tight end room is great. We all know how good Mitchell Evans is. Eli Raritan had a great game. The quarterback room is going to feel good. The running back room is disgusting. Like, Aeneas Williams was the best running back, and he might be the fifth guy this year. Like, it's just ridiculous. You have three guys who could start at most power programs. So the offense is looking great. The defense, we talked about D-line. The linebackers, they're young, but I like them. I really like them. Jack Kaiser's a steady force. So much upside. Jalen Sneed looks like a monster. KVA, Viliumaasa, Kingston Viliumaasa, the freshman, people have been raving about him. He looked great. Drake Bowen, our friend of the program, looks great. He looks like he's going to be the starting Mike this year. Keanu Kia, who went to do a Mormon mission for 2 years, has come back, and he looks really good. He had like 11 or 12 tackles in the game. So I really like how that room's coming together. I feel pretty good about that. I also got to give a shout out to Bryce Young. He's been the most talked about freshman, son of Bryant Young, true freshman, just a monster. He's going to steal snaps for some people. I love it. And then you got the DB room. Morrison wasn't playing, but Mickey was there. Gray was there. Micah Bell has just transferred, but they'll probably bring someone else in. You got Jordan Clark in the slot. Jaden Osberry is going to be half linebacker, half slot cornerback to play in that, the nickel package. And then safety, you know how good Xavier Watts is, and you're going to have a battle. Adon Schuler has been really good lately. He's going to probably be maybe the starting safety, if not Rob Hurd, the transfer from Northwestern. So, yeah, Steve, to your point, this roster is great. They added a kicker. He missed a kick on the, but it, you know, there was conditions and stuff, but it was spring. Mitch Jeter, highly, highly accurate kicker from South Carolina. They did lose turbo foot Bryce McPherson, the punter. They'll replace him. Point being, I know I just did a quick roster breakdown. This team's good. This team is really good. This is the best team of Marcus Freeman's tenure. It is absolutely a team capable of going 12-0. In fact, I think they should go 12-0. I don't see Florida State beating us at our home in November when they've lost so many players. I'm almost more worried about A&M just because I think of that Texas game from 2016 where we should have beat the brakes off them. But, you know, it's a big matchup, night game in Texas. You know, the crowd's in it, and you just kind of get swallowed up by the moment. So Freeman's going to have to win that game because those are games we haven't always won as a program, and then he struggled with a little bit as well. The Clemson game, you know, the one coming to mind. So Notre Dame's got to win that game. But if they beat A&M, I feel really good about this team. The blue and gold game is great. The coverage was great. Marcus Freeman is great. Coach Denbrock, like, I am so in love with him. He, the 11 personnel, the way the offense looked, Steve, was fantastic. They were slinging the ball. They were getting out quick. They were using the running backs. They were using deep play action. They were using just deep plays in general. I loved it. The run game looked good. It's buzzing. This is the best I felt about Notre Dame in so long. Doesn't mean we're going to win a national championship this year, but I think it's coming. Like, this program is they're right on the precipice, and I think you just need a few breakout stars, and this could, and that's what happened in 88, by the way. A lot of freshmen and sophomores on that team broke out and utterly dominated their competition that year. So I'm really excited, man. Like McDonald's, I'm loving it. So
yeah, no, I certainly agree. And yeah, it's a program on the ascendancy. We've always talked about this year being the year, you know, the 24-25 window. And again, it, you know, the window did open a year early last year just because we still had so much talent on the roster, and Sam Hartman, you know, did give us a chance. Just imagine Denbrock with Sam Hartman last year, right? And Sam, you know, again, you're coming from the slow mash and with a little bit different, you know, there was a difference there, but like he did play well. He really, really did. I don't think, you know, best of luck to, you know, to the old offensive coordinator, Gerard Parker, but it just wasn't the right time for him, to be the OC at Notre Dame. He would have been a great OC at another school. It's just like, it's Notre Dame. It's the kingpin of college football. You need the best coaching for the best players. And Denbrock is going to make such a difference of this offense. And that's what I'm so excited for. So yeah, I mean the coaching staff, the administration did not set us up for as much success as we should have had last year. They have invested, they brought in the guys, they're letting Freeman cook. The roster's there. The staff is there. They just announced that they're going to be building some, like, however much million-dollar athletic complex right next to the Goog specifically for Notre Dame football players. So that's going to help with recruiting and again, with player development and everything, because you know they're going to make that state-of-the-art and amazing. So it's a great time to be a Notre Dame fan. It's always a great time to be a Notre Dame fan, because at least we're not Michigan fans. But
Yeah. I mean, I think they're a little happier at the moment, but we're not even going to acknowledge that. I do want to talk, we'll do this on another podcast, but I do want to talk about the coaching turnover, the portals, the recruiting class we brought in 2024, a little more of the team stuff. This was a little more NCAA generally and the upcoming things. So we'll do another show on that, but just briefly, getting Mike Denbrock, what a blunder LSU made. They had a deal, but they played around. They did not get it past whatever kind of formality they needed. A certain board needed to approve it. And that let Freeman swoop in. And I think he just loves Notre Dame. It is a better job. It's harder. It's a lot harder than LSU. But it's Notre Dame. It's the Yankees of college football, man. You don't get bigger than this. And I know a lot of LSU fans weren't happy with that. But Freeman chose Notre Dame and Denbrock. Kelly left for reasons to do with how easy it is at LSU. And he just kind of plateaued at Notre Dame, and that's fine. I have no problem with Kelly going to LSU. I've made peace with it a long time ago. I think it's a win-win. I think LSU gets a great CEO who puts little work in yet still gets great recruiting results because it's Louisiana. They get that calm, steady rock in that program. And I think Notre Dame has somebody now in Freeman who could surpass that ceiling that Kelly could not break, because it requires, obviously, more on recruiting, more on player development, more on transfers. And that's where Freeman has just set the bar for me. It's just blowing me away. He's got to translate it on the field, though. You know, I don't want to give him that break. It's got to turn into wins.
This has to be at least 11-1 minimum.
Yeah, as long as they make the playoff, it's a 12-team playoff this year. So as long as they're in that, you know, I'll give a little grace room. But they need to that, and they need to win a game. I think they need to host and win a game. 11-1, 12-0, beat up on some G5 team or have Ole Miss come in South Bend in December, but win that game. That's my expectation. But we'll do a separate podcast on that. Do you want to move on to the draft that's starting tonight, or anything else with the blue and gold game?
No. Let's head on to the draft. There is a gentleman by the name of Joseph Bartholomew Ault. I don't know if his middle name is Bartholomew.
I was going to say, that's amazing.
No, but Joe Ault, he's going to make a lot of fucking money tonight. He's projected anywhere from, what, fifth overall to like eighth overall. He's, you know, don't overthink it. He's a top 10 pick. He's a future Hall of Famer. He's a 10 to 15 year starter at offensive tackle. So I mean, that's obviously the big headline, and congratulations to him on securing the bag tonight. And hopefully he goes to a team that's not going to play my Pittsburgh Steelers very often whatsoever. But other than Joe Ault, I mean, if you wanted to kind of go down the list of the other prospects that Notre Dame have, or any sort of thoughts.
Well, let's play a game. I'll read you everybody that was given a combine invite, and you give me, I know you're not a draft expert, nor are you a scout, but just kind of give me what round, if any, that you think they could go in.
I could be a draft expert and a scout. You don't know that about
me. I know you could. Well, I know you have the potential to. I just know you're also a new father with a new home, and scouting college players at the moment isn't your thing, nor is it mine. But I think I have a good feel for the draft. I think you do as well. So let's start with we'll just do it in the order I'm seeing it on this list here. Quarterback Samuel Joseph Hartman. I don't know if that's his middle name, but what do you think of the Golden Boy? Is he going to get drafted?
Sam Hartman should. He deserves to be drafted. He showed mobility. You just think back to, what was it, 4th and 31 or whatever the fuck it was at Duke when he made that game-saving scramble.
Let's play it.
Yep. He has grit. He's thrown a ton of balls. He's read a ton of defenses. If there's ever a guy that you might think can handle, you know, interior pressure because of that slow mesh system he came from, like, he's a guy that can hang on to the ball until the very last second and let it rip. He throws a beautiful spiral. You know, whether or not his, you know, being able to read a defense translates to the next game and arm strength translates to the next level, that's yet to be seen. But at the very least, he should be selected in the 6th or 7th round. And if my Pittsburgh Steelers were to pick him up in the 6th or 7th round, I would be absolutely thrilled, because, you know, he's a guy that could probably spend 2-3 years on a roster without ever seeing a snap, but eventually making his way into a backup role and possibly backdooring himself into, you know, eventually a starting role in the NFL. Like, I think a nice comparison, because of the grittiness and because of how many balls he's thrown, is Gardner Minshew.
Okay. Right?
I'm not delusional. I'm not expecting, you know, Tom Brady or Patrick Mahomes to, you know, out of Sam Hartman, but I think he might follow that Gardner Minshew path. So if he can get 6th or 7th round, good for him.
Yeah, I think that's spot on. I think he'll end up on a roster. Even if he doesn't get drafted, he'll be signed. But yeah, I think late day 3 is fair. I think some team will take a flyer on him. You know, at the worst, he's competition for the room. I like Sam. I think he's a great college quarterback. We'll see if that can translate to the NFL. But yeah, I think you're spot on there. So moving on, this might be my favorite player in the last few years at Notre Dame. However, he plays a position that doesn't really matter. And that is running back Audric Estime. Had a slow 40 time at the combine, but rectified it on pro day. I've seen him go, kind of projected to go somewhere. What do you, where do you think he should go?
If this was 1994, he'd be a top five pick.
Yeah, fair.
But, you know, because of the devaluation of the position, you know, you're basically not getting running backs in the first round anymore. You know, a very few will pop up here and there. So automatically he's relegated to second round and beyond. Now, I personally, Kyren Williams was a third round pick, and I think he is.
Is he third round? I thought he was, later.
Could he be a third or fifth? One or the other. But yeah, I mean, I think that.
He was undervalued, by the way. Like, Estime, I think, is getting valued fairly well. Kyren went way under the radar in his draft.
Yeah.
He was fifth round, 164 overall.
That's what I said, exactly. So, yeah, I mean, if Kyren was a fifth, then Audric is maybe coming in the fourth round, I'm going to guess. I think that he has second-round talent. I just think there's also a valuation, you know, a position valuation that might ultimately push him down. Because I think that everyone is going to basically run towards offensive linemen in the first three rounds.
Yeah, the talk is O-line and corners are going to be the run of the first round. I think you're spot on. I think he'll go in the fourth. I think he has capability of being the top running back in this group. There was a great chart out there comparing like either yards gained or EPA versus how many men were stacked in the box. And this just is a sign of Jarrod Parker's tenure at Notre Dame. But Estime led the list. He had the toughest running matches in terms of just stacked boxes and did the most with it. To me, to the extent that running backs' production is in their own hands, that to me is a good sign of it, that Estime can turn chicken shit to chicken salad, as we say. So... I think I would take a flyer on him in the third for sure. My Dallas Cowboys need a running back. I don't know. We have so many other needs. I don't know if the third round would be great. But I think that's a fair projection, late day two, early day three. Love me some Audric Estime. It has nothing to do with him. It's just the position value of a running back. But I see, look, I'm not going to say he's Derrick Henry, but I see a little bit of that in his game where he's so big. He's so hard to tackle.
Hard to down, dude.
And you just put that behind a competent offensive line, and I could see him having a fantastic NFL career. The next on the list is Joelle. We talked about him. There's talk recently that the Alabama tackle might go first. Latham. Yeah, that would be horrible, in my opinion. The Penn State guy.
That seems like a Raiders pick.
It does seem like a Raiders pick. the Penn State offensive lineman, is it Fasciano? There was talk about him versus Alt early in the season. I think Alt has clearly won that debate, so it's either going to be Alt or it's probably going to be Alt going first, but if not, because the Chargers are stupid, he could fall a little bit. I don't see him getting past 10 by any means. I think he's a surefire top 10 pick. But yeah, we'll just move on to Blake Fisher. I thought he left earlier than he should have, to be honest. I thought he could have improved his draft stock. And another year at Notre Dame as a left tackle could have given him a first-round projection. But he is getting talked about a lot, plus the offensive line's a premium position. Where do you think Fisher's going to go, and do you think, you know, that's he'll go appropriately where he should?
Yeah, exactly. I think if he stayed one more year, he's a late first, early second in next year's draft. This year, coming out a year early, I think he basically pushes down. So he'll be... maybe late second, just because he has been a riser here. But more likely early third is my educated guess again.
Yep, spot on. I'd give him a 2-3 grade. I think he'll get drafted probably around there.
He started more of a third grade, fourth, fifth round projection, but like people have been really talking highly of him. So good for him.
He has versatility too, right? Like I thought since he came out of high school, he was better as a guard. And he's been a tackle his whole career at Notre Dame. I think he'll probably be a guard at the next level. But he has that ability to be a tackle, at least. He's got 34 3/8 wingspan, which is actually larger. That's hands. He's got 34 3/8 hand length, which is... that can't be right. I think the stat's wrong. Sorry, guys. I'm just reading off of another another source. I was trying to see how big he is compared to Joelt, because Joelt looks perfectly for tackle. I just get the feeling Fisher's more suited for guard. That's kind of where I was going with it. Let's just move on to Javonte Jean-Baptiste. I think he's probably being underrated. Where would you grade him?
Yeah, he played damn well.
It's fantastic.
Yeah, and that's the thing is, like, he has the frame, and like, his game held up in really big games, like against Ohio State, coincidentally. Like, he looked phenomenal. So I think that he should be getting picked in probably the late third round, but I he'll probably get picked in, like, the late fourth, early fifth is my guess.
Yeah, I think he's someone who's just going to go under the radar. I'd probably guess around five, but he should be higher, I think. I think he was a fantastic player for us. JD Bertrand, what do you think there?
I think just because of, like, size and speed, I think he's an okay size, just not, like, you know, kind of the idealistic prototype that the NFL is kind of looking for. And speed is probably going to put him, again, as maybe a fifth round pick. And I think that's about right. That's a fair valuation on him. And he could, again, play himself into, he'll probably start as a backup, but I think he projects to be an NFL starter someday, and can probably get, you know, a 7 to 8 year career, which is
definitely, I see, not in his game necessarily, but I just see a Drew Tranquil path where he gets undervalued and then just works his way onto a team. I hope he gets drafted. I would guess day three if he does. I think he's a really good player. I think JD Bertrand's super underrated. I can see him having an NFL career. Yep. We'll move from one linebacker to another. A guy who I didn't think was getting much NFL buzz early, and I think I've seen him in mocks get drafted, so I'm happy for him. He's a great kid. Maris Leofau. I had mentioned at the USC game, I ran into him at the event before on Friday. Nice guy. Like, held the doors open for people. Kind of, like, respectful, like a total Notre Dame guy. I'm really happy for Maris to get drafted. I really hope he does. What do you think?
Yeah, he's a sixth rounder, my guess. He has a bit more of the prototypical frame that is going to translate well to the NFL, and he has good speed. Yeah. But I think between his ears is where he misses the most tackles. Right, like he's just going to take, like, better lines at runners in the open field, and kind of just read offenses better. You know, translating to the next level, he did a really, really good job in college, but there was also kind of some cracks in the game that you could see, and at the next level, you better believe that that's going to be exploited if he's not in his A game. So I think body wise he's probably a mid rounder, probably a third or fourth rounder, just based on his body, but because of his brain, he's probably gonna fall a little bit more than that. So maybe fifth or sixth round is my guess.
Yeah, I'm more concerned with the injury history if I was a draft team, just because he had suffered a really nasty one. He ran a 4.64 40. Yeah, I think it was. And I think that kind of slowed him down a bit. I think he's, like I said, a great guy. I really wish him the best for him. I think day three, I think he will get drafted. But yeah, him and Bertrand, I think, are kind of in similar boats there. And then last but not least, Steve. He seems like he's been at this program for 100 years. Cornerback Cam Hart, another riser, which I think absolutely deserved. I mean, he was maybe him and Ben Mo were. You could argue Cam Hart was the better corner this year. I don't know if I would agree with it, but you could argue it. He was good. He was really good. He's big. He's 6'3", 202. The NFL loves that. He tested outstandingly at the combine. He ran a 4.5 flat for a guy of his size who's not really known as a speed guy. That's a really good time.
And he shut down Marvin Harrison Jr.
Yep. So where would you draft Cam Hart?
If I was the Pittsburgh Steelers, I would take him with a third round pick every day of the week, twice on Sundays. I think he's probably a fourth rounder.
I think you're spot on. I would pick him day two, but I think he'll probably go round three, round four. I think that's right. But yeah, and he's a guy I think could have a great NFL career. My only concern with him would just be he's a little older. He's also had some injury history. So that would be just a flag for a team, but I don't think that's a big enough issue to, you know, let him slide into day three. I think he's without question, a great player that I would pick in the first three rounds.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
So that's it for the draft. How are you feeling about it tonight? Are you going to watch?
I'm not. I'm on husband duties. I got a whole bunch of doddering and doting to do once I get downstairs. I also got to cook dinner and whatnot. So I won't be. I mean, I'll follow along on my phone or everything, but I won't be watching live. But yeah, I mean, hopefully we go. What was it? 7 for 7 in terms of drafting. Hopefully all the guys that we mentioned all get picked and get lucrative deals, and hopefully they get picked higher than what they project to be, because I want them to all make more money and do really well for themselves, because all of them were really awesome at Notre Dame, and I appreciate their time there.
Yeah, and I don't want to forget about Thomas Harper either, the transfer. He wasn't at the combine, but he's someone I think that could maybe get drafted, if not end up on an NFL team somehow. So I'm wishing all those Notre Dame guys the best, of course. You know, it's a great family. I love the Notre Dame family. The players, the coaches, the fans. It's a great community. You guys know that.
Yeah. And if the last couple of years have been any sort of indicator, almost all of these guys are exclusively going to be drafted by the Detroit Lions. So.
Well, that's fine with me, because I got no beef with the Lions, and they're in a different conference for you. So let's just hope all the Notre Dame guys go at franchises we're tolerable with. So for you, that means nobody at the Ravens. For me, that means nobody with the Eagles. And then, yeah, maybe one of our teams will take them. So, I think that's it. It was a longer one today. We had a lot to cover. Oh, by the way, Notre Dame beat Oregon State in the Sun Bowl, blew them out.
Jordan Faison is that dude.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's our game recap.
That's our game recap, everybody. I know you were waiting for it. So, you know, an hour and 20 minutes in, there you go. We predicted a blowout. It was a blowout. Faison looked good. Angeli looked good. Defense looked good. Oregon State was playing second and third stringers. Doesn't matter. Feel good. 10-win season. Up the Irish. Let's go.
I love it. All right. Well, Dylan, it's been a pleasure. Programming note, we're probably going to record something sometime in June. Baby Campy is due here in basically like the week of 4th of July, so hopefully sometime in June we'll catch up, and we'll let kind of some transfers and rosters crystallize, and then we'll kind of start previewing everything. We'll go over recruiting at that point, get a little bit more in depth. Thank you all for listening. Listen, share, rate 5 stars, review, make fun of us, the whole nine. You guys know what to do. Thank you again for listening. I appreciate you all. Dylan, see us out, brother.
At HorsemanPod on Twitter. It'll be the best follow of your life. We love interacting with you guys. Thanks for listening. Thanks for interacting with us. And then, yeah, you know, Godspeed, everybody, until fall camp. It'll be a little bit of a boring summer, but is anything really boring in the college football world? So who knows? We'll see y'all. Go Irish.